this is a worldwide phenomenon. In every single culture, there's stories of similar organisms, and something really must be going on. And that's part of my interest and fascination with cryptozoology.
News, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, welcome one and all. I am Micah Hanks, glad to be your host as we go careening off through space and time in pursuit of the enigmatic, like we do every Monday night from 7 to 9 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. Let's lock in, my friends. Oh, and by the way, happy Doctor's Day to all of you out there, doctors and laymen alike. A little more on that later, as well as information about our special guest. We have a bit of news that is breaking, including enigmatic mysteries of squids and various other sundry biological things. And later in the program, in honor of Doctor's Day, in this very important time when we need doctors, my guest will be Dr. One Pagan. He is the author of the book Strange Survivors. And we're going to be talking with him about not only the very mysterious and at times very odd ways that organisms manage to get by, but we're also going to be touching on a favorite topic of ours, his, mine, and many of you, that's right, what he calls credible cryptids. Those creatures as yet unproven to exist, but for which there is maybe a stronger case than those of the average cryptozoological variety. So I'm really excited to dive into this conversation with One Pagan. It's been a long time coming, by the way. And anyone who follows me on Twitter probably sees the good doctor and Lauren and Rune Erickson over there in the land of ice and snow and some of our kith and kindred interacting on Twitter almost on a daily basis. One goes by the handle Bald Scientist on Twitter, by the way. So if you've seen him, that is going to be our guest. And in addition to being an educator in Pennsylvania and also a research scientist, he is the author of numerous books, but Strange Survivors will be the one on the table with him tonight, so really looking forward to that. And again, how fitting to have Dr. One Pagan joining us right here on National Doctors' Day. And for those who do not know about this, this is a day held every year on March 30th in the United States. According to doctorsday.org, it is a day to celebrate the contribution of physicians who serve our country by caring for its citizens. The first Doctors' Day observance was March 30th in 1933 in Winder, Georgia. And this involved Eudora Brown Almond, who was the wife of Dr. Charles B. Almond, who decided to set aside a day for honoring physicians. That first observance also included mailing greeting cards and placing flowers on graves of deceased doctors. On March 30th, 1958, a resolution commemorating Doctors' Day was adopted by the United States House of Representatives, and in 1990, legislation was introduced in the House and Senate to establish a National Doctors' Day, which we know in modern times and which, on this date of broadcasting, we observe and celebrate. Now, they also note here that following overwhelming approval by the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives on October 30th, 1990, President George Bush signed S.J. Resolution No. 366, which became public law 101-473, designating this date, March 30th, as National Doctors' Day. Boy, I could not think of a better time to be observing this highly underrated holiday, because right now we need our doctors. And as it goes without saying, in various parts of the world, and especially locations like New York, we've got so many of our doctors out there working overtime right now, doing what it is they do best, which is saving lives. And here in a moment, we'll have an update from New York. But first, we have a transmission coming in of the cosmic variety from somewhere out there in space and time.
Oh, hi. This is an emergency transmission. If you're seeing this, the TARDIS must have detected an upsurge in psychological signals from somewhere in space and time. Basically, I think somebody somewhere might be a little bit worried. I'm actually just self-isolating, or as I like to call it, hiding from an army of Sontarans. But keep that to yourself. Now, here's what I do in any worrying situation. One, remember, you will get through this, and things will be all right, even if they look uncertain. Even if you're worried, darkness never prevails. Two, tell jokes. Even bad ones, especially bad ones. I am brilliant at bad ones. 3, be kind. Even kinder than you were yesterday. And I know you were super kind yesterday. Look out for each other. You won't be the only one worried. Talking will help. Sharing will help. Look out for your friends, your neighbours, people you hardly know, and family. Because in the end, we're all family. 4, listen to science and listen to doctors. Right? They've got your back. 5, stay strong. Stay positive. You've got this. And I will see you very soon.
That, of course, coming from a doctor of space and time, who many sci-fi fans like yours truly will be well familiar with, Jodie Whittaker, the actress who currently portrays the Doctor on the BBC's Doctor Who television series, sending a message of hope to all the fans out there that was posted online recently. And it is incredibly touching to see an actress doing her part and reminding people, be kind to each other. Don't be afraid. Never forget that darkness never prevails. We look throughout history, we look at every instance where there have been dangers, where there have been threats to all of civilization, and all of those past threats have one thing in common. Humankind always prevails. We always do. And that alone should be a message of hope. But in times like these, where so many of us wish that we had a time-traveling doctor who could save the world from a threatening virus strain, it is so very important for us to remember that in every country, in every state, in every county, in every town and city, we have doctors. We have lots of them. We have a world full of doctors. And at times like these, when we have a world in need of saving, it is indeed very comforting to remember we have a world full of doctors, not just one, and they are working around the clock to save lives. So yes, trust your doctor and trust science. This is a time right now when we need a whole lot of both, and fortunately, we've got them. But also remember that if those doctors are going to be able to do their jobs the very best that they can, we all have a role to play. And that's why it is so very important that in so many towns, in so many cities and municipalities, there are these shelter-in-place and stay-at-home orders. Guys, we all need to observe those unfailingly. Because even if you're young and you're healthy, and you're looking at this saying, you know, why do I have to worry? You know, most people, 80%, are either asymptomatic or they have mild symptoms when this coronavirus actually strikes. Please don't forget that you are one of the ones who could be carrying this, unbeknownst to you or anyone around you, to the rest of the population who may be even more adversely affected by it. So again, we all have a role to play. And if we all are willing to stay at home and engage in a little social distancing, we will buy more time for those doctors who are working diligently to save lives. So thank you on this National Doctors Day to all of you doctors out there and the fine work you're doing. We need you now more than ever. And it sure feels good just knowing that you're out there. All right, time to get to a little news. And I do want to remind you guys before we do that although we will touch on news related to coronavirus, my pledge to the listeners of my podcasts is that we do not want to oversaturate the programming with nothing but gloomy news about this. You know, that's why I decided last week to have the fantastic Dr. Thomas Glass join us. And I want to also thank all of you guys who have sent messages, emails, tweets at me, thanking me for having him on the show. You guys really seemed to appreciate that. And see where we were coming from. I mean, a really serious discussion, a non-sensational one about not only the coronavirus and what we know about it currently, but also preventative measures and how to help stop the spread, but also touching on a little UFO research and our mutual interest in that subject. I really appreciate that you guys were receptive of that because right now it is so important to use every channel and medium that we can to disseminate good information, credible and reliable data in the midst of this outbreak. That's one of the most important things that a podcaster can do, and not engage in conspiracy theorizing and silliness and speculation. Right now is a time that we need facts just about as badly as we need doctors. So thank you again to Dr. Thomas Glass. Thanks to all of you guys for being receptive to that. And please do remember that In these unusual times with so many people stuck at home and looking for ways that they can digest information and content, my pledge to you as a podcaster is, one, to keep them coming, two, to keep them enjoyable, and three, also to keep the shows inspiring, whether we're talking about UFOs or some of the truly strange mysteries in the world of biology, like we'll discuss with Dr. One Pagan a little later. I want you guys to enjoy this program, and no matter how bad things may be outside our homes. Now, getting over into a little news on that note, I'd thought about tweeting the other day at Elon Musk. I wanted to tweet something along the lines of, Elon, you often talk about wanting to save the world with technology, and right now, if you want to save the world, find a way to get more ventilators to places like New York. Well, here is some good news. Apparently, he's already on top of that game. As of last Wednesday, according to Live Science, Elon Musk had already offered to start manufacturing ventilators for coronavirus patients if need be. Well, immediately medical practitioners and politicians jumped on board and they said, please, please do this. And so it seems that he got right to work and he tweeted just the other day, we expect to have over 1,200 ventilators to distribute this week. Getting them delivered, installed, and operating is the harder part. Now, of course, with any luck, he's going to be able to get some help on that side of things, but I am so thrilled to see people who have the time, who have the funding, who have the resources to be working in an effort to help and to do their part. And like I've said, yes, those who have money should be making donations to the American Red Cross, you know, to any number of other organizations. In fact, I'll try and link a few in the show notes, because keep in mind right now with so many schools closed, there are school lunch programs that ensure lunches for kids who, if they were at home all the time, otherwise may not have them. And now, in addition to not being at school and having those lunches, a lot of these kids are not only now at home, but in their communities, there also may be food shortages in the coming weeks. So yes, there are charitable organizations that are ensuring food will be provided to families in need, and any number of other critical areas of American life and life for those elsewhere around the world that are also being affected. In other news, apparently some of the space moguls out there aren't faring quite as well as Elon Musk is currently, because Space.com reports Bigelow Aerospace has reportedly laid off all of its employees. And according to the Space.com report here, they say Nevada-based Bigelow Aerospace, which has long aimed to set up outposts in Earth orbit and on the moon, let 20 employees go last week and then laid off all 68 of its remaining workers. They say sources have told Space News' Jeff Faust that the moves were caused by a, quote, perfect storm of problems. And yes, this did in part have to do with the coronavirus pandemic. Apparently, they say on March 20th, Nevada Governor Steve Sisolak ordered all non-essential businesses in the state to close in an attempt to slow the virus's spread. Now, there was a spokesperson from Bigelow also who said that the company planned to hire workers back after things returned to normal, but other sources felt that the layoffs were likely to be permanent. Now, this is where things get a little tricky because, again, right now, a lot of businesses are actually being advised to lay off their workers temporarily. And they're saying that essentially moving workers to part-time actually prevents them from being able to get unemployment benefits, something so many American workers right now are actually taking advantage of. So it very well may have been in the employee's best interest to lay them off if indeed those layoffs are temporary, but it's anybody's guess how soon operations may be back up and running and how long many businesses, not just Bigelow Aerospace, may be affected by this. So that was certainly some big news in the world of space in just the last few days. You know, Lauren sent this one, and this is a great story in advance of our conversation with Dr. Pagan a little later. According to Science Daily, there are some fantastic new qualities being observed in squid. That's right, revealing yet another superpower in the skillful squid. They say scientists have discovered that squid massively edit their own genetic instructions, not only within the nucleus of their neurons, but also within the axon. That, by the way, being the long, slender neural projections that transmit electrical impulses to other neurons. How are they able to do this? Well, scientists are still trying to figure that part out, but they note here that this is the first time that edits to genetic information have been observed outside of the nucleus of an animal cell. You know, there was that article that circulated a while back, and a lot of speculation stemmed from that cephalopods are essentially very alien. It's no wonder, in other words, why so many science fiction films essentially portray aliens as being squid or octopus-like. But it's not just their appearance that makes them so alien. I mean, let's just run down the list really quickly. First of all, you've got the strange pairing of an invertebrate, a creature with no bones. And in the case of an octopus, even if you've got an octopus, when he has all of his legs outstretched and he may fill a space, you know, with a circumference of maybe 10, 12 feet, that octopus can fit through a hole the size of a quarter. And there are videos online that show them doing this if you doubt me for a minute. But now you pair with that the fact that cephalopods are highly intelligent too. Despite having no bones and being able to fit through a hole the size of a quarter to make a daring escape, these are intelligent creatures. They can use their arms to open bottles or jars. They can solve puzzles. They can even use their arms to communicate gestures and symbols to other cephalopods, which are akin to sign language. Highly intelligent creatures, unlike almost anything else in the animal kingdom. And now this new study with regard to squids, also talking about their ability to edit genetic information outside the nucleus of an animal cell, doesn't get much more alien than that, at least as far as Earth life goes. Now, according to Science Daily, the discovery provides another jolt to the central dogma of molecular biology, which states that genetic information is passed faithfully from DNA to messenger RNA to the synthesis of proteins. And a lot of this actually goes back to 2015 with a study at that time that found that squid could edit their messenger RNA instructions to an extraordinary degree. They say orders of magnitude more than humans do. So other organisms do this, but not like squid. And this, of course, allows them to fine-tune the type of proteins that will be produced in the nervous system. Now, according to the lead author of that study, we thought all the RNA editing happened in the nucleus, and then the modified messenger RNAs are exported out to the cell. Now we are showing that squid can modify the RNAs out in the periphery of the cell. And that means, theoretically, they can modify protein function to meet the localized demands of the cell. So what does all that mean? Well, Rosenthal says that gives them a lot of latitude to tailor the genetic information as needed. Boy, you talk about strange survival. Of course, we'll be talking more about that later in the program with our guest, Dr. Onay Pagan. I want to check in also with a friend in New York in the segment to follow. Ryan Sprague will be jumping on the mic with us to talk about how things are up there in the Big Apple. I am Micah Hanks. It is the Micah Hanks program, and we will be back right after this. I'm Micah Hanks. Welcome back. Continuing our coverage of all the strange things space-time has to offer. And before we proceed further into the program, the other day I had reached out to a few of my colleagues in the community, and Ryan Sprague, of course, in New York, certainly came to mind because of the way that the Big Apple has been affected by the coronavirus thing. And so the other day, Ryan was kind enough to jump on the mic and talk with me, give us an update of how things are up there currently. We featured this on the Middle Theory program the other day, and I thought it would be very important to do so here as well, considering that Ryan is well known, of course, by many in the UFO research community. Joining us now is Ryan Sprague, a longtime friend and colleague of mine who is right there in New York, and he is currently on lockdown. Ryan, how are you doing and how are things up there?
Hey, Micah, all things considered, I'm doing pretty good, man. Thank you so much for reaching out. I think you're right. Finding community right now is all we can do. And yeah, it's interesting times for sure.
Well, it really is. And in fact, what got me thinking about reaching out to more people, in addition to the fact that there are so many people in affected areas who I haven't heard from yet. I just spoke to Race Hobbs this morning, thankfully, and he and I had a long conversation about all of this. And they are practicing, he and his wife, the utmost standards of safety. They are self-quarantining. They are trying not to expose themselves or risk others, put others at risk. In that regard, with the whole concept of flattening the curve, you know, we've all got to kind of do our part. And so I was really impressed and also enthusiastic when I saw yesterday that you were reaching out to friends of yours in the community and saying, guys, you know, let me know how you're doing, how this has affected your flow and your workspace and your lifestyle and your day-to-day life, you know, your research, all these sorts of things. So, you know, you're doing kind of the same thing. And again, as podcasters, that's really important that we share information, that we share good information, and that we keep in touch and just make sure that everyone is, you know, faring as well as they can in the midst of this crisis.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think this is a real time of reflection. I mean, you know, my job here in New York City, we were one of the first to be sort of shut down before, you know, the statewide New York shutdown went in effect. So I did what I could. I started podcasting. I started researching. I started going back into all my books and my archives. And I'll tell you, man, for all the horribleness going on, it's been a blessing for me as a researcher to really take my time to reconnect with a lot of people I haven't talked to in a while. And to, like you said, just do whatever we can to get through this. You know, I can't lie. It's been a little scary here in New York. I've never in my life heard it this quiet. I've been here for almost 12 years collectively now, and it's a little creepy, man, at night. I'm not going to lie. There's not a single sound out there except sirens.
That is incredible. I mean, they say the city that never sleeps, for it to be silent, that must be almost as scary as some of our concerns about the actual virus strain. Let's talk a little bit about the temperature there in New York, not in terms of weather, but in terms of, you know, how things are proceeding, what the general feeling is, you know, what the response has been from, you know, local government, the whole nine yards. I mean, what are your perspectives on how things are shaking down up there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when it comes to local government and everything, I live in Queens, New York, about a 25 to 30 minute train ride from Manhattan, Times Square area. I would say they're doing an incredible job here, to be completely honest. The way they're handling this, the way that everything is being communicated to us is just been absolutely stellar. And I mean, every local government up to the top of the, you know, White House, they're all stumbling along at this point because we haven't experienced something like this ever before. So in terms of that, I think we're doing pretty good. Personally, you know, it's interesting. I think a lot of people have this idea that New York or Los Angeles were like living in Thunderdome right now, you know,
right.
It's like Mad Max apocalypse, martial law style. But I'll be honest, you know, we're going out, we're walking around the neighborhood, grocery stores remain open, essential businesses remain open. So I'll pop out every now and again, but I am keeping that 6 foot distance from every person I see because, again, one of the most populated cities in America, you never know. So it's been interesting.
Well, of course, yeah. And again, I had those concerns. And at this stage in the way that things are developing, I haven't had an opportunity to talk to that many people in New York yet, which is here again why I reached out to you. I'm so glad to hear the way you're describing things. You know, are people, and again, fill me in, as far as the silence at night, are people staying in of their own accord, or is the city on lockdown? Is there an actual curfew kind of situation going on?
I mean, there is an official lockdown, but I try to stress to people, you know, we do still live in a democracy. So,
right.
You know, you are allowed to leave your apartments. You're allowed to go out. You might get questioned if a cop drives by or, you know, I haven't seen any type of security or National Guard or anything like that. Not yet. I'll say not yet, but I mean, you're sort of free to do as you will, but you just have to be very careful. You know, the parks are empty. Thank God people aren't congregating there. But yeah, man, it is eerily quiet. And a part of me really likes it. And another part of me is really missing the energy that's here. It's just so stagnant and static, and he just I never in my life imagined this would be the New York City I was living in.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure that some of the energy will come back, but you know, I can relate to some of the things that you're talking about there. You know, police actually stopping and asking people why they're out. I had a friend that over in the next town right here in Western North Carolina where I am, had not been out for a few days, went to town, got a cup of coffee, had been sitting on a park bench, and a police officer drove by and said, "It's not safe for you to be here, sir. You need to go home." And they made him go back. And he said, "What in the world is going on?" And this just in a fairly rural mountain community here in North Carolina. So, you know, we've seen even a little of that here. And of course, you know, it's been announced that yesterday the president has deployed the National Guard in an official capacity in New York, Washington, and California. But you know, the local National Guard divisions had actually already been operative in a lot of these locations as it is. And you're right. There is, of course, this problem with saying, you know, you cannot do this, you cannot go there. Yes, we live in this democratic society. It's not like other parts of the world where literal quarantines, shutdowns, you know, and mandates can be imposed. So it's a very unique situation where people need to take advice that is being given to them and yet not feel like there is too much imposition. That's a very interesting thing as far as the way that we all relate to and understand the workings of our government, I think. And it's going to be like that probably for a while.
I would have to agree with you, Micah. I mean, this isn't a black and white situation. As the days sort of trickle on, a lot of people are struggling, you know, when it comes to where's the economy heading? Where is that curve heading in terms of cases and, you know, the infections continuing and the virus spreading? And there's no right answer. So what do you do? I think this, we're all living in an uncertain time. We don't know what's going to happen hour by hour, but I think doing what you're doing and what other podcasters and entertainers and academics are doing is finding ways to connect and to even honestly to distract ourselves for a couple hours. If you're watching the news ticker 24/7, I wish you luck making it out on the other side of this thing sane. So I don't know, man. I have hope that things are going to get better. They have to. And I just think if everyone is careful and responsible, I can speak from experience. I've lived with a mother who has been immune compromised her entire life as an organ recipient. Mm-hmm. So if I can say anything to the people out there still congregating and still think you're invincible, think of that person to your left, your right, and in front of you. Right. It's not just about you.
Exactly. And that is something. And again, I really should say it here before I let you go, because in some of the conversations I'm seeing, many are pointing out the fact that, well, you know, most young, healthy people, in fact, around 80% of those who contract the virus, they're going to be suffering from only mild symptoms, or they will be asymptomatic. They won't have any problems at all. So why worry? Well, that's the very thing that actually allows this virus to spread, that insidious aspect where some people may suffer virtually no effects at all if they are carrying it. Even if they aren't impacted, they are going to be the invisible carriers of something that is potentially deadly for others. And so, yes, you're so right. We've all got to do our part. Think about the others around you in your environment. Even if you are healthy and able, that does not mean that the rules don't apply to you. We have to be thinking in terms of communities right now, and we all play a part. Ryan, thank you so much. Listen, stay safe up there, and if you will, maybe keep me in the loop about how things are going in New York as we progress. And of course, as always, I wish you all the best up there, bud.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Micah. Stay safe, stay healthy, and see you on the other side, man.
Special thanks again to Ryan for taking time in these trying times to check in with us. Let us know that he's doing okay up there. I know so many have been affected in New York and other places. So you guys all stay safe out there. And of course, I'd like to hear from you also. info@MicahHanks.com. If you'd like to send along your insights about where you are and how things are, we will be joined when we come back by Dr. One Pagan here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. And shifting gears away from news, and of course all of the things that are happening right now in the world that have so many of us keeping tabs on the latest developments, glued to our smartphones and computers. With all of this news that is breaking, it is important to break away from time to time, enjoy ourselves, engage in some enlightening and, frankly, inspiring conversation. And that's why I think that my guest this week is so very important. In these trying times, it's always wonderful to hear from an uplifting voice. And we certainly have somebody joining us today that I think you will find as delightful as I do. Somebody I really respect and admire, because he is a husband, a father, he's a biology professor, a scientist, a blogger, a writer, and he's also the author of a book that I've had my sights on for a very long time, Strange Survivors, How Organisms Attack and Defend in the Game of Life. But the good doctor we're about to speak with is more than just a science advocate and educator. He's also a deep thinker. And our guest and I recently spoke on the telephone, and he approached me about a topic. He said, I would really love to talk with you about what I call credible cryptids. And I said, I really want to talk with you about your book. So it looks like we've got a conversation percolating. Ladies and gents, without further ado, I welcome to the program Dr. Oney Pagan. How are you doing, Oney?
I'm fine, Micah. Thank you for having me on. And it's an honor. I've been a fan of yours for a long time. And please call me Oney. The title is for my students.
Yeah, that's right. I always love to say the good doctor, but Oney, again, it's such a unique name also, by the way. Right there really quickly, tell folks a little about your background, where you're from, and how you got into the study of biology.
Okay, well, I'm Puerto Rican, born and raised in Puerto Rico. I used to be a non-traditional student, meaning that I went for my PhD when I was 35. I already had my bachelor's. I got married. I had my first, my daughter. I did my master's, and I had to work. I had a family.
Yeah.
So at 35, the opportunity came up to go to Cornell University. I got a scholarship, and we went there, and the rest, as they say, is history.
That's right.
As far as biology and science is concerned, I've always loved science. Everything and anything. And for my bachelor's, I did it in general natural sciences because, I couldn't commit. I took astronomy. I took biochemistry. I took, I love all those things.
Yes, you are very much like me in the sense that you have a passion for science in general and all different areas. One week, and again, I'm completely on the avocational side of things. I'm just a citizen scientist at very best, at least in my own backyard on a clear night when I've got my telescope handy. But, you know, I may go from astronomy to biology to archaeology. I love the scientific process. And, you know, again, science is a wonderful tool. Scientists, I like to always remind people, are not perfect. We're all humans. And it's important, I think, to keep that in mind because we see the same biases often that we see in science like we do in every other walk of life. And that's what's so refreshing about speaking with someone like you, a truly open-minded scientist, an educator who wants to try and, you know, show people how good science is, what good it does for us in the world, and honestly, how fascinating it is. That's really kind of where you get into with Strange Survivors. The world is a strange place, and I'm sure as a biologist, you are so well aware of that.
Absolutely, and I couldn't agree with you more. And also, science is for everyone, not just for a few selected people, as it were.
That's right. Yes, science, and that's something else I often try to point out to people, because many, I think, feel that if they are not scientists, that goes over my head. You know, that's something that's beyond my abilities or interest. I always advise people to read popular science books like what you've written. Again, it's something that is engaging. It's fun. And the more that people get into this subject, the more that they see that it applies to them and their everyday lives. In fact, on that subject of life, I mean, that's really kind of the million-dollar question. I'm going to put it to you. I want your opinion on this. When we're talking about life from a biological perspective, what is life? What do we mean when we talk about life? Do we even really have an idea of what life is, per se?
In a nutshell, we have no idea. Okay. what I'm trying to say by that is that we are very good at describing what life does. All right? It's like the old joke, I'll know it when I see it. Okay, that's pretty much the way scientists deal with life. But there is no universal definition that that everybody accepts. Okay, there's going to be some controversy. And that's part of the fascination. And that touches on many types of fields, including, for example, astrobiology. Okay? We can only explore astrobiology in a rather systematic way once we get an established definition of life. And so far, we don't have one. And that's part of the allure, as it were.
Yes. When we are looking for alien life, for instance, and we're going out there, astrobiologists, you know, SETI researchers, generally there are only two things we can hope to do. We can hope to, A, look for what are called technosignatures, the evidences of an advanced civilization far enough out there that would be indicative of life on another world similar to ours, or we base our suppositions on what we observe here on Earth, and we go out there looking at moons and planets, and we look for evidences of the impact, for instance, that organisms might have on not only the environment, but the atmosphere, and try and find little clues that might point to the idea of life. And I like this expression, rather than life as we know it, life not as we know it, or life as we would not expect it. And so it's kind of difficult to go out there into the universe expecting to find other organisms when we are very limited. All we have to basically go off of is what we know from here on Earth. And despite all that diversity, it may be pretty limited in the cosmic sense of things. Your thoughts?
And you're absolutely right. Those two ways are the only ways that we have so far to try to find life, either by their technological know-how or by the chemical signatures that they may cause in the planet. For example, there is no known purely chemical process that can produce oxygen, molecular oxygen, in a sustained manner, okay, other than photosynthesis, okay? So if we find a planet by spectroscopy or any other type of a similar technique, and we find a high oxygen signature like ours, 21% or so, that's a strong indication of photosynthesis. Some other scientists have looked at methane in Mars, for instance. But again, until we get something that is undeniable for everyone, it's going to be very difficult to define.
Yeah.
And it's, again, part of the challenge.
Oh, absolutely. And a challenge it certainly is. You know, something struck me early on as I was reading your book, Strange Survivors. At one point, you say, we are all mutants. Now, most people, when they think about the idea of a mutant, right, they're thinking about the X-Men or a Marvel Comics character. Most of us don't look at ourselves in the mirror every day when we get up and we're getting our hair fixed or shaving and say, ah, hello, mutant, how are you? What do you mean by that? How are we all mutants?
Okay, I can relate when you say that you're shaving, but not when you're combing your hair because I have no hair. So that's one of the things. But joke aside, that's the thing. Mutations have a very bad rap because sometimes we associate mutations with something that is harmful, and it's nothing of the sort. Some mutations are indeed harmful, but the vast majority of mutations are simply changes in the DNA sequence of an organism, okay? So, for example, humans, we are about 7+ billion people. And unless you have an identical twin, the DNA, your DNA is unique, okay? So in a real sense, whether you have blue eyes, brown eyes, beard or no beard or white beard or no hair, those are mutations. Those are variations in DNA. And that's those mutations feed biology. They feed evolution. Because if a population has no variability, it will be unable to evolve.
Right. So, in other words, the very fact that we are all mutants and the variability that results from that process of mutation not only applies to all life on Earth, but it also is what we can credit to our ability to survive in many ways. Yet again, some of that strange survival you're talking about.
Absolutely.
Yes. When it comes to life, I want to talk in the context of what life is or what we know about life and how it prevails in times of stress and disorder, even like the current pandemic in which we are. I want to know your thoughts on, in terms of what life springs from. There's this great perennial question about how does order and life seemingly spring from the inanimate? What are your thoughts on that?
Okay, well, it's undeniable that life is a chemical phenomenon. Okay, there's no dispute about that. As far as how it goes from life, from non-life to life, it's a problem of a frontier, for example. Let me explain myself. So the basic unit of life is the cell. A cell is the minimum ensemble of molecules and processes that generate life. And I realize it's a circular definition, but it's the best we can do at this moment. Now, no molecule is alive, not even a little. Okay? So the hemoglobin molecules that are in your bloodstream right now, they are not alive. They perform a function and everything that contributes to life, but they're not alive. So the frontier between life and non-life must clearly lay on between the realm of molecules and the realm of cells, right?
Mm-hmm.
But nobody knows where the blasted frontier is. Okay?
Uh-huh.
So is there something that it's kind of alive? You mentioned viruses again. Some people argue that they lie in that fuzzy frontier between life and non-life. And in a real sense, they are. Because a viral particle in itself, on top of a table, it's indistinguishable from a speck of dust. And only when it gets in contact with an appropriate host, it comes back to life, quote unquote. Yeah. So that's one of the biggest problems in biology nowadays. And many people who are way smarter than any of us will ever be, we're talking about theoretical physicists and like-minded people, are trying to come up with solutions about that. But I'm not very optimistic at this moment.
Huh. You know, it reminds me of something, and I brought this up to you on the telephone the other day. I had read a NASA study a number of years ago that had been speculating about plasma life forms or something similar to them springing into existence in space. And the study had looked at the way that essentially space dust in certain studies had been shown to behave in unique ways and even to sort of collect and begin to form little structures that were very similar to DNA, helical little structures and things along these lines. And they said that if there's a natural propensity for inanimate matter to do this in space, could this be a similar process that we observe even in the vacuum of space that would give rise to the kinds of building blocks, if not actual life, that they might give rise to the sorts of building blocks for life? Now, that's a tantalizing proposition because the NASA paper in question had been speculating, what if, again, very lifelike forms might come to pass in places we would never expect them, and they may not be life like we would expect to here on Earth, but they essentially use the expression plasma-based life forms. Something else that this sort of suggests is, of course, that idea of panspermia, the idea that those building blocks for life may have actually originated from space and in the ancient world came to Earth, perhaps arrived here on a meteorite or something along those lines, and that could have actually, quote-unquote, seeded life here on Earth. I know you touch on this in Strange Survivors. What is your feeling about panspermia?
Oh, well, let's back up for a second because I found something very interesting in what you told me about plasma life and phenomena like that.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that we have to take into consideration when trying to define life, its relationship to the environment, with the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that goes even to an old science fiction story titled "The Cloud" by Fred Hoyle. I don't know; I'm pretty sure it was Fred Hoyle.
Yeah,
the same person who dealt with the idea of panspermia. And in that science fiction story, they discover an interstellar cloud who is alive and sentient, okay? We don't know if anything like that could be even possible. It's not forbidden by the laws of nature as we know them, okay? So that's one thing, and it would be a very interesting possibility. In terms of panspermia, that's something that is a serious scientific hypothesis, and life may have well originated elsewhere, and Earth can be seeded, like in I remember Prometheus, the movie. I'm a science fiction fan. Okay, so that's I'm gonna use a lot of comparisons about that. So
well, I like that.
So some people believe that something like that could have happened on Earth. Okay, and even if that happened on Earth, remember that it only brings the problem back to where life originated from. Okay, so that tells us when life originated on Earth, but not how life originated originally.
Right.
If you know what I mean.
I do, yeah.
But it's an interesting proposition, yeah.
It is very interesting, and actually on that note, since you mentioned Fred Hoyle, I should point out that there's been a bit of speculation circulating recently from Hoyle's collaborator, Chandra Wickramasinghe, and he has proposed a radical idea. He calls it that, so I'm borrowing his own terminology, and I don't endorse this idea, but I raise the proposition here to make a couple of points. Chandra has suggested that the current coronavirus could be of extraterrestrial origin. Now, I actually wrote about this the other day, and I said, let's say on the seemingly outlandish possibility that theory is correct, if that virus strain is of extraterrestrial origin, then I would argue that it is no more extraterrestrial than you or I and all other life on Earth, in keeping with that idea of panspermia. Now, what's interesting is many biologists, many scientists from different disciplines, they say, you know, that's an interesting idea. It's possible. And if indeed life on Earth as we know it has cosmic origins, as this model proposes, then sure, you could say that a virus strain that originates here on Earth, also far enough back, just like we do, may have at least ties to cosmic origin. But as far as the idea, and this is where I differ with Chandra's idea, he essentially has argued that a meteor that was passing through the sky over China may have actually released the pathogen in question. I find that theory to strain credulity in light of what we already know about coronaviruses and their origin. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with you in terms that, evolutionarily speaking, we know, and by we I mean the scientific community in general, not personally, of course, they have traced the evolution of this particular strain of viruses. So, also, the meteor that fell upon China in that particular date fell about, I think it was a couple of thousand miles away from the original city or region.
Yes.
Where this virus originated from.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's something, it's a little bit of a stretch. That being said, if Dr. Chandra's hypothesis has some merit, it will have to be tied up with the idea of panspermia, meaning that it would have to be the kind of life that infects us would have to be DNA or RNA based. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Other types of genetic material will be grossly incompatible with our biology.
Absolutely. And when we return here with Dr. One Pagan, things are about to get electric, because we're all essentially electrical organisms, but when it comes to strange survival, some organisms have taken electricity to a whole new and shocking place. We're going to ask Dr. One his thoughts about that when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program.
We'll be right back.
coming to you live from the quarantine zone deep below the Appalachian Mountains. I am Micah Hanks. Hope you guys are all doing great out there. And as we head into hour two with our very special guest, Dr. Onay Pagan, I am eager to talk with him about a topic that we both love, credible cryptids. That's right, living fossils and those animal species that may exist out there, but which science hasn't yet recognized. We'll get into that a little later. I do want to remind you, of course, if you enjoy this program, these are very trying times for everyone, but of course, many are at home and listening to podcasts, and we always, every week, offer additional content for this program in the form of the X subscriptions. It's just $7 a month or $77 a year, and that gets you access to a weekly additional edition, the X Podcast, and also the monthly special known as Enigmas, which we're going to drop a new episode of that here in just the next few days. Jeff Smith, my good pal and crypto cohort, recently pointed out to me that LeVar Burton, remember LeVar from Reading Rainbow? He's been asking people to live stream bedtime stories and things along those lines. I'm toying with the idea. Yeah, I would think that that would be a lot of fun to maybe read some H.P. Lovecraft for the kids at night. Right? You guys all read Lovecraft to your kids at night. You don't? What? Really? I'm not the only person who thinks that that's a good idea, surely. Well, even for those of us who are a little older than maybe the general bedtime reading age, you know, a few ghost stories and some weird fiction in the evening sounds like a fun idea. So I don't know, maybe that's something we can do. A lot of us are going to be spending more time at home, and in the weeks to come, I'd toyed with that idea. I've been toying with a lot of different ideas. So if you're interested in things along those lines, I'd love to hear from you. info@MicahHanks.com. In fact, during these times, I'd like to hear from you in general. info@MicahHanks.com. And also, you can tweet at me @MicahHanks. And of course, for this week's X podcast, Dr. Pagan has agreed to stick around and do some additional commentary on everything from hallucinogenia, the Cambrian explosion, symbiosis, the brain, science, and cryptozoology. Heck, we might even talk a little about extraterrestrials, you know, all that fun stuff that happens over there for the X subscribers. But getting back into the conversation right now, I want to shift gears a little to a peculiar function of certain biological, I mean, we're all actually electric organisms, essentially. But in your book, Strange Survivors, you talk about certain organisms that have evolved in very novel ways, and they utilize bioelectricity in, I mean, quite literally shocking ways. Let's talk a little bit about how we are all electric organisms, and then maybe shift over into organisms that utilize electricity in very unique ways as defense mechanisms and other things.
Sure thing. Well, to begin with, every type of organism that has ever been studied, it's dynamic, meaning that it has the capacity to react to the environment and do things based on that. Okay, and the way they do that in the overwhelmingly majority of cases is by changes in the electrical properties of cells. Okay? So there's electrical particles called ions, and can be like sodium, potassium, whatever. And changes in the concentrations of ions in and out of the cell can determine cell behavior. Okay? For example, if you're going to, right now you and I are talking, our brains are hopefully functioning properly, and they are controlling our muscles and in the way that we can talk and express myself. Right now, even though you are not looking at me, I'm gesturing with my hands. That's what I do.
Right.
Okay. So, and those movements, that those type of activities are controlled by small changes in the electrical properties of cells. Okay. And that's universal. Any organism deals with that. Some other organisms have upped the ante, as it were, in the sense that they have evolved ways to use macro currents for defense against predators, to attack, to detect their environment, every conceivable thing. That's one of the most beautiful things about biology. Remember Ian Malcolm? Life finds a way.
Oh, yes.
In Jurassic World. Oh, yeah. So, one of the best known organisms that use electricity for those purposes are the electric rays, and electric eels. And I recently learned that there's even some electric catfish.
Right.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. And those are particularly the electric catfish are found in African waters. They're not the regular catfish that we can find around here. But organisms like that, they share a particular characteristic. They have a specific organ called the electric organ that it's developmentally derived from muscle tissue. It's not a muscle, but it's derived from muscle tissue. They have two main characteristics. One, their cells are arranged like the plaques of a battery. Okay? Did you ever disassemble a car battery to see what it looks like inside?
No, I didn't, but now suddenly I have this insatiable desire to do so.
Okay, I did when I was younger, and that may explain a lot. But the thing is that car batteries, at least the ones that I used to disassemble when I was, 17 or something like that, they have plaques, okay? And you add the battery acid, and through a series of physical chemical properties, they can store electricity. So those electric organisms, they have organs with cells arranged like that. In addition to that, they have a series of protein molecules that conduct the electrically charged particles that I mentioned before. Okay? They are found in a concentration that is 1,000-fold the concentration that is found in your muscles or mine. The net effect is that when they activate their electric organ, they generate macro currents. You know that a common electrical outlet in any house is about 110 volts,
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Right.
These animals, for example, the electric ray, are capable of packing a punch of maybe 400 volts.
Wow.
And the electric eels, about 800 volts. Okay, so
goodness.
Those things can pack a punch. They use them, again, to attack predators or to become predators themselves. They can use them like sonars, for example, to detect their environment because they live in murky waters,
mm-hmm.
And they also use it for presumably for communication within the same species. There's also a very interesting link between electric organisms and early forms of physical therapy.
Oh.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know that, for example, you're too young for this, but when you get, for example, a sprain muscle or something like that, and they send you to physical therapy.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes they apply heat, and sometimes they actually apply small currents of electricity to stimulate the muscles to heal. So in ancient Greece, one of the main prescriptions for people when they had gout, this particular disease that is very painful on the legs and whatnot, was to step on an electric ray.
Huh.
That was their treatment. People have used nature in that way for millennia now.
Now, see, that's really interesting to me, One, because first and foremost, of course, there are the speculations about certain imagery that we see in places like ancient Egypt, and people try to equate that to the use of electricity in ancient times. It seems fairly unlikely. Barring all discussion of Baghdad batteries for the current moment, which, again, I've seen pretty plausible alternative explanations. But in theory, the idea that people were studying electricity in the ancient past and that they understood that property and that, as you point out here, with a natural source like an electric eel or a electric ray, that they might utilize that for therapeutic purposes. Now, that is very interesting, and it does give us a plausible thread that we can connect to where we can say, okay, yeah, people in the ancient world, they may not have had a full and complete understanding of electricity, but they recognized this property, and they used it for therapeutic reasons. Now, that's really interesting, and in addition to that, it also reminds me on the therapeutic side of things of the use of leeches in bloodletting.
Yeah, that's an ancient practice that actually currently used in many types of, for example, surgeries and microsurgeries, because The leeches have the a component that deals with inhibiting clotting and phenomena related to that, which is beneficial when you do microsurgery to, I don't know, reattach an ear or you know, any type of surgery like that. It's currently used in that sense.
Yeah, it's incredible. It kind of shows that in many ways, it's hard to capitalize on or improve certain things that nature already does so well. Now, something else that really fascinates me about organisms and the way that they utilize novel mechanisms to aid in their survival has to do with poison. Now, actually, I want to make a distinction because few people probably ever think about this outside of biologists. And in your book, you break down the difference between poisons, toxins, and venoms. Can we talk about those three distinctions?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, poisons is kind of an anthropomorphic term, okay? So, anything that can kill you is considered a poison, all right? Mm-hmm. But more biologically, toxins and venoms can be distinguished by a couple of key things. When we're talking about a venomous organism, we're talking about an organism that is capable of injecting a complex cocktail of substances. Each of those substances, it's considered a toxin, okay? Mm-hmm. A rattlesnake, a bee, a cone snail, okay? They have specialized organs that are associated with true hypodermic needles that can inject their venom into an organism. A toxin, on the other hand, relates to much simpler substances that have to be administered passively. For example, we don't talk about a venomous plant. We talk about a poisonous, toxic plant. Mm-hmm. Because no plant will chase you around. You know, poison ivy, thank God, will not chase you around to you know, get you poisoned, okay?
Yeah, thank goodness.
There's a maxim. I don't know where it came from. I'm really trying to find out the source, but if any of your listeners know the source, I would appreciate if they let me know. Let us know. If it bites you and you get sick or die, it was venom. If you bite it and you get sick or die, it was toxic.
Well, okay? That's a really good breakdown, yeah.
Yeah, so I wish I knew what it came from. But because it's like that, for example, you know that it's very dangerous to go in a field and whatnot and see, for example, a mushroom, and without knowing exactly the type of mushroom, you just go and eat it. That's a gamble.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Some of them are nutritious. Some of them will get you high. Some of them will kill you right outright. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and that's part of, but that mushroom needs your cooperation to pick it up and eat it. Okay.
Yeah.
So a rattlesnake needs no cooperation on your part. You just have to be careless enough to be on its path.
Actually, I've got a couple of addendas I've got to add here before we get back to poisons, toxins, and venoms. But on the subject of, first and foremost, the rattlesnake. So we have a unique situation where we have a venomous snake. If it bites you, you will be poisoned. And this creature also has this unique evolutionary and correct me if my terminology is wrong here, but is it an adaptation, the rattle on the snake's tail, that gives it a warning system, hey, I'm dangerous, so don't come near me. So it lets you know it's there so that you are less likely to step on it. Would we call that an adaptation?
It is an adaptation, and it's most likely related to biochemical economy. Okay? Mm-hmm. To manufacture a complex venomous cocktail, it's biochemically expensive. You have to invest a lot of energy. So it makes sense for a rattlesnake, if it can avoid it, using that venom, just by warning you to step away from it, it benefits the snake. So it doesn't have to waste that energy, if you know what I mean. So there's a couple of additional ideas related to that. In many cases, organisms prefer to warn their presumptive enemies, not to mess with them. Okay? Mm-hmm. We can talk about, for example, poison arrow frogs. Okay? They are tiny frogs. They're, I don't know, maybe about an inch long, not bigger than that. And they are very brightly colored. They stand out in their environment. Okay?
Yes.
Why would an organism that is small, cannot fly, doesn't have any fangs, stand out in their environment? It's to advertise, well, you eat me at your own risk.
Yes.
And it's kind of the same idea. It's biochemical economy.
Now, that's interesting, though, for another reason, which also gets us over sort of into the plant side of things. The ways that communication are used by different organisms, and even interspecies communication. I find that really interesting, or actually, I guess it may be intraspecies communication. If we've got, for instance, a poison dart frog communicating with birds that are flying overhead, hey, I'm bright, I'm colorful, you can see me very clearly, and that should let you know not to bite. Or you've got the rattlesnake that's communicating to a hominin like you or I, you know, here comes a great big bipedal ape and it's saying, I'm going to let you know I'm here so you don't step on me because I want to keep my venom. But if you get too close, I want you to know I'm locked and loaded and ready to go. I mean, it's fascinating to me that there are all these levels of communication between organisms that occur in this way.
Yeah, it's fascinating indeed, particularly because it works at the level of the population. Mm-hmm. Okay? For the thing is that, let's suppose that you have two birds that see the same poison arrow frog, okay? The one that eats it and dies, it's unlikely to leave descendants. You need to be alive to reproduce, okay? So that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
The other bird that actually looked at the frog and got a little leery and didn't eat it will get to mate, will get to reproduce, okay? And those genes that actually were responsible for that aversion to that color, okay, get conserved in the population. In the case of humans, okay, we also have an additional level of complexity in terms of culture. Because when we have, for example, in a tribe, and we know that one of the members of the tribe ate that fungus, and died, that it communicates to the rest of the tribe, and everybody tells everybody else, unless you don't like them, okay? That's a stupid joke, sorry. So don't eat that particular, mushroom and whatnot, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, now that I mentioned stupid jokes, that's one of the, it's a little digression, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the unofficial techniques that I use when I'm teaching. You know, that's kind of my main gig, teaching students in right. addition to research. The thing is that I love telling lame jokes, like dad jokes. I'm a master of those
yes.
for a couple of reasons. Because I'm a dad, and that's what I do. Okay? Second, life's too short to be all grumpy.
Oh, yes.
If I can avoid it. Okay.
Absolutely.
And I can get grumpy. Don't get me wrong. I can get grumpy, but I try not to.
Yeah, see, One is really good at dad jokes, ladies and gents. I, on the other hand, specialize in bad jokes. Rhymes with dad, different category altogether. So I'm going to leave the dad jokes to you, One.
Absolutely.
But go ahead.
My main reason for telling stupid jokes in class is that we are all raised and that's coming for the last 40, 50 years in an age of distraction, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We are all conditioned to a few minutes of close attention followed by commercials or a text or something that, you don't know, a butterfly, the proverbial squirrel, okay? And when I see a significant fraction of my class that is not quite here, if you know what I mean,
mm-hmm.
I crack a stupid joke, I get a courtesy laugh or a pity smile, and hopefully I reset their attention
Wow.
So they can come back to me.
Well, that's a unique adaptation that you have developed there, my friend.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, that aids. And really, we might say that since that ensures your efficacy as a educator and thereby prevents you from finding yourself unemployed, that also is an evolutionary strategy that ensures your survival and that of your kindred, huh?
There you go.
We could in a roundabout way make that argument. I want to come back around. This may not have to do so much with poisons, but on the subject of fungus and mushrooms, as you know, I'm very interested in the psychedelic components and their relationship to perhaps everything from altered states of consciousness to even human cognitive development over time. The late Terence McKenna had proposed in his book Food of the Gods a very interesting novel theory. He called it, I believe, the stoned ape hypothesis, where he had said that if we observe in the ancient world how many cattle cults, how many different cultures revered bovines, and of course we know that certain varieties of psychedelic mushrooms tend to grow on the cattle dung in these fields where the cattle range, it very well may be that there could be a link between people's worshipful attitude toward cattle and the psychedelic components that they might have discovered as foragers, early hunter-gatherer societies who were looking for different food sources. Like you mentioned, many mushrooms are deadly poisonous, but when they discover one that not only is edible and it doesn't hurt them, but it gives them this incredible visionary experience, and we take into consideration shamanic practices in different parts of the world and cultures all over the world and how they utilize psilocybin and compounds found in mushrooms like that, it really raises some interesting questions. But now from an evolutionary perspective and also in terms of, you know, the sorts of communications between species that we often talk about in conversations like this and like you and I are touching on, I'd love to get your take, Onay, on what role the psychedelic compound in certain plants and mushrooms plays in relation to humans and more broadly.
Okay, it has to do a lot with agricultural practices, okay? And there's a couple of theories that actually propose that people develop certain agricultural practices to supplement with their diets nutritional deprivation states from when there were, I don't know, a famine or a drought, things like that. For example, there is a particular neurotransmitter that it's the best one. It's called acetylcholine, okay? And it's related to Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, it's related to muscle contraction, you name it. It's everywhere. Mm-hmm. Now, one particular type of receptor molecule that deals with acetylcholine, it's also sensitive to a specific compound that is very well known called nicotine. Okay? So nicotine is, of course, mainly derived from tobacco plants. Let's suppose that, I don't know, 50,000 years ago, there was a person suffering from nutritional deprivation for whatever the reason. They would eat anything, right? That's what you do when you're very hungry.
Sure.
So that person saw that tobacco plant. It took a couple of leaves, it chewed on them, ingested them, ate them. That nicotine in tobacco plants will get into the system and substitute, even if it's a little bit, for the natural neurotransmitter. So the person will feel better. The person will say, well, I feel a little more perked up and whatever. So they will consider that plant sacred. Mm. They will actively take care of it. The sacred people or shamans will become very valued for all the plants that they knew with desirable properties. Okay, so that's a, in a nutshell, a very broad school of thought. Also, as you said, many other plants produce even more dramatic properties in terms of psychedelic experiences. Okay, I've read about the theory of Dr. McKenna, mm-hmm. but and there's a couple of things that are more controversial than others. For example, as you well know, he proposed that the big jump in human consciousness, whatever consciousness is, that's yet another rabbit hole that we can go into.
Sure.
Was triggered by the ingestion of psychedelic mushrooms. That's something that is, there's no evidence to indicate that can trigger something like that, okay, in terms of consciousness. But surely it related to the behavior that people had in terms of how they cultured, and they sought out the particular, I don't know, fungi that were, mushrooms that were beneficial to them.
Right. Yeah. And I'm with you. There have been a lot of novel theories about the actual origin of consciousness. Julian Jaynes comes to mind, and the old bicameral mind concept. Still a fascinating book. And for anyone who is interested in theoretical approaches to understanding the development of consciousness, Julian Jaynes, The Origins of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. Fantastic read. I also recommend that Food of the Gods by Terence McKenna. But again, sometimes it's great to propose a theory without becoming married to them. I find a lot of these theories interesting. I don't necessarily marry myself to them. But I think that biologically speaking, there is some precedent for your approach that we can see in other areas of the animal kingdom. For instance, extant great apes like gorillas. Sometimes we also see proboscids like elephants. They will utilize natural painkillers from the plant kingdom if they've got a toothache or if they're suffering from pain. And if we can observe animals other than humans doing this, to me it makes a pretty good case for the idea that early humans also discovered the properties of these various components. And I don't necessarily equate the use of something like, for instance, psychedelic compounds with the origins of consciousness, but I think it very well could hold a, it could play a role in the development of ideas and the expansion of human thought processes over time, which gives rise to certain elements of culture. And that much we could also say anthropologically there is more evidence for with the prevalence of shamanic practices, altered states of consciousness and spiritual practices that are really just, I mean, seen throughout cultures all over the world. So for me, One, it really comes down to follow the evidence. Where does it lead us?
Absolutely. And we can go even further. Some people argue that our current, pharmacological practices, we learned from observing animals. Okay. And not only our cousins, the apes, but not only elephants, but even, for example, you know that if you ever had a dog, and they get a stomach ache or something like that, they don't eat anything. They go out and chew on some grass.
Right.
So they do that. And many different types of animals, including insects, for example, are able to do that. So I absolutely agree with you. It's conceivable that by observing nature, we learn to take advantage of plants, for instance.
We are talking with the good doctor, One R. Pagan. He is the author of the book Strange Survivors. And I tell you, if a conversation like this doesn't get your gears turning about the mysteries of life, what life actually is, and some of the amazing things that we find when studying nature, I don't know what will. It is the Micah Hanks Program. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. One R. Pagan, our guest, really enjoying this conversation with him. And we've got so much that we need to get into. Of course, looking ahead, also some of those lesser discussed interests that many in the field of biology have. Yes, that of course has to do with life forms that may not yet be recognized by science. And this of course brings us to that topic of cryptozoology. Now, many would deem cryptozoology pseudoscience. For my own part, One, it really has more to do with how you go about it. There are a lot of credible scientists who are interested in cryptozoology, but then again, I also think that going out there in the middle of a national forest in a relatively populated region, taking a baseball bat, hooting and hollering and banging on a tree and calling for Sasquatch, that's probably the more pseudoscientific side of things. On the other side of this topic, there is the legitimate case for what you call credible cryptids. maybe we can talk about a few of those. And, you know, one example you gave the other day on the telephone, of course, is an all-time favorite of mine, the coelacanth. The idea of a living fossil. Let's start there.
Sure, sure thing. But if you let me start with a little bit further than that, in a way.
Yeah.
Just to let you know that I'm one of those scientists who is fascinated with cryptozoology. Okay? Mm-hmm. And it goes back to my early college days. I was a freshman in 1982, and I've always been a bookworm. Okay? So and look at libraries and stuff like that. And one fine day, I found this book from someone you may have heard about, Bernard Hubelman.
Yes.
Okay. And we're talking on the track of unknown animals. And I spent a good part of my freshman year where I should have been studying, but a good part of my freshman year was spent reading that book. And that triggered my interest in cryptozoology. And I suspect I'm not alone in that sense.
That was a gateway drug for many of us, my friend.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And going back to the coelacanth, in a real sense, it's the poster boy for cryptozoology. We're talking about an organism whose fossil record stopped 65 million years ago. Okay? At the time when dinosaurs were wiped out by the really big rock from the sky that no mutation could protect us from. Okay, so yeah. That's 65 million years ago. And yet, in the 1930s, somebody discovered a fresh coelacanth in a fish market. That blows my mind. And ever since then, we know that there's at least, that I know of, I may be mistaken, two different populations of coelacanth that are currently studied. They go down there with submarines and they are able to take them and record their behavior and everything. Okay, how many organisms who have not left fossil records are around nowadays? My personal hope, for example, and it's a really long shot, I would love to learn that trilobites were still alive somewhere.
Oh gosh, yeah.
And trilobites are some of the most fascinating invertebrates in prehistoric life. And I don't know, but it's again, a person can dream, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I would love that maybe, I don't know, in the waters of Antarctica someday when we get to explore these type of things, we find a living one. But
yeah.
Who knows?
When I was a child, my mom and dad used to take me to rock and mineral shows, and I was, you know, quite the amateur geologist and collected a lot of rocks, but what really fascinated me were fossils. And I had little trilobite fossils when I was a child, and I used to hold those, and they were no bigger. You could place one on the head of a dime. They were so small. But again, the way that this little ancient organism looked, to hold that fossil in my hands and think, my gosh, something like this crawled around on the ancient earth, that just blew my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And you are in good company in your interest in geology. Charles Darwin was originally a geologist. I'm sure you know that.
Yes.
And that was his fascination the whole life. So you are in very good company, my friend.
Yes, indeed. We do tend to keep good company in this field of interest. You know, on that subject of living fossils, something really interesting and striking that you point out there has to do with the fact that where you mention the fossil record for creatures like the coelacanth ending so many millions of years ago, and yet we find an extant population of them today. And that was a real game changer, an animal we never expected to still find in the modern world, still thriving. Now, it really begs the question, when we say that, for instance, and I've got to use probably the, if we're going to talk about the poster child of cryptozoology being the coelacanth, I think I've got to say that the national animal of cryptozoology for the United States and North America in general would be the Sasquatch. In my opinion, I mean, this is this creature that, and actually all around the world, the wild man as an archetype is fairly ubiquitous. But for me, Sasquatch is fascinating because of the way that people tend to talk about this with a given attitude that this is purely mythological, this is utter nonsense, and we all kind of enjoy talking about Sasquatch, but nobody really believes in this animal. Now, what's really unique to me, and I try to suspend my belief or disbelief on that topic, I approach it with cautious skepticism but open-mindedness, right? To me, a topic like that is incredibly interesting because after having reviewed a lot of the existing literature that's been collected since maybe the 1950s by authors like John Green and Renee de Hinden, Peter Byrne, who I had the pleasure of speaking to last year, Grover Krantz, and a number of others, there are a lot of professionals from different areas that really took the stories seriously, that worked diligently to collect a record of eyewitness encounters and accounts. They went and sought physical evidence, but very little was actually recovered. But nonetheless, many of those researchers came away saying, I'm convinced that there is some reality to all of this. Now, for those who have said, no, it's impossible, one of the key arguments that they raise is, there's nothing in the fossil record to support the existence of a creature like Sasquatch. Generally speaking, in terms of fossils and our discussion of them, what is your take on that idea, the assertion that, well, if we don't find it in the fossil record, Sasquatch couldn't exist?
Okay, so first, I agree that the evidence of something like Sasquatch or Bigfoot actually exists around there. And I mean no disrespect for all the people who have experienced something like that.
Right.
Okay, so they have certainly seen something. And I would never, of course, there's your share of people who are not truthful, okay? But it strains credulity to me that everybody is lying about that, if you know what I mean, okay?
Yes, yeah.
So in terms of the fossil record, we don't have a lot of fossil record for chimpanzees, for instance. They live in a particular type of environment that is not very amenable for fossilization. They live in a tropical forest. When one of them dies, it gets eaten by anything that can get their paws on, okay? Mm-hmm. And yet we know that there's chimpanzees around, okay? The same applies for gorillas and other types of animals. In fact, the gorillas are a very interesting example that parallels Sasquatch because it was, if you could remind me, because I'm not sure exactly when it was discovered by modern science, but I think it was in the 1800s.
Oh, yes.
When the gorillas were actually discovered. Prior to that, there were a legend of a big ape that, you know, that pretty much like the legends that we have nowadays. Now, I'm not saying that I believe or disbelieve. And you touch upon that in one of your recent podcasts yourself. We don't have a body. That's the main thing. Not even, we don't even have undeniable DNA evidence. You see what I mean? So until we get something like that, I think it's right to take the existence of such a cryptid with a grain of salt. And this is, again, my you know, amateur opinion. I'm not a primatologist or anything like that, okay?
But certainly,
that's the way I think. That being said, it would be incredibly interesting to find something like that. And as you always said, this is a worldwide phenomenon. In every single culture, there's stories of similar organisms, and something really must be going on. And that's part of my interest and fascination with cryptozoology.
Absolutely. Again, Bernard Heuvelmans that you spoke of earlier, he did a lot of groundwork in terms of collecting data about supposed relict hominins. And that's a term that is generally used these days by Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum of Idaho State University, who is really these days the leading scientific proponent for the existence of the so-called relict hominids or hominins.
And he knows what he's talking about. That's his actual professional field.
Yes, he is so interesting to listen to and to read. And for anyone who's seen an interview with Dr. Meldrum, I hope to reach out to him in the future myself. I've actually reached out to him in the past. But if you haven't read some of the science papers that he has made available online about this or read his book, Sasquatch Legend Meets Science, even if you do not believe in Sasquatch and if you hold no hope that there is even a possibility for the existence of one, that book still makes for very interesting reading, I think, from a theoretical perspective. Same, I would say, of the late Dr. John Bindernagel and his book, The Discovery of the Sasquatch, really all of his writings. I love reading the interpretations by scientists who have given thought to this topic. I love seeing what modern scientists have had to say about it. It really makes for some very interesting discourse in relation to philosophy of science. But now, on this subject of relict hominids, one that you brought to my attention the other day when we spoke on the telephone had been Orang Pendek, an alleged very small human-like primate said to exist in Sumatra. There may be some historical record that exists which supports ongoing sightings of these creatures over the last several centuries. And again, there is still a contention among many people indigenous to that part of the world today that this creature actually may exist. You list this among your grouping of credible cryptids. What particularly draws you to Orang Pendek?
Well, first of all, there's admittedly anecdotal evidence of so many people that have seen entities like this. Second, there's precedents of relic populations of humans, for example, that haven't been discovered even in the 20th century. Okay, that they are isolated in a deep jungle and whatnot, and they're only discovered by, I don't know, a plane that's flying over a certain field or something like that.
Right.
Second, it's conceivable that they are still around because, let me put it this way, I find them more credible than some other, you know, ideas of hominins and whatnot, because they can be a relic population of some of our earliest ancestors, like the Australopithecines, mm-hmm. For instance. But we get into the same problem. We haven't found any, DNA evidence or things like that. There's been some reports of people that have gone and collected evidence and supposedly sent to people that know how to deal with DNA analysis and whatnot. But I haven't heard any results related to that. There's many names for them, not only Orang Pendek, which translates to short person. And there's a variation of the theme, which is called the Orang Kardil, which means tiny person. And they are probably one and the same. And they are rumored to have to use spears, and that they hunt in packs. I mean, just much more in showing a behavior. Pardon me if I'm rambling a little bit because I get enthusiastic about this type of thing.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead. Ramble on.
Yeah. They display a behavior that it's more human than primates, like chimpanzees and whatnot.
Yes.
Even though chimpanzees, they are beginning to show, and gorillas and whatnot, like the beginnings of culture, but that's yet another topic. So, but I really think that's one of the best bets nowadays to try to find a relic, a hominid.
Yes.
That being said, if they are around, sometimes I feel that they don't discover them at all. And bear with me for a second. They will be human, and they will be inevitably caged or studied and whatnot. And I don't know how to feel about that, if you know what I mean.
I do know how you, yeah. And again, this is what I was addressing on the show a couple of weeks ago. For many, they would say, it's absurd. Why are we even talking about whether or not a Sasquatch body could be found, the ethics of whether or not a hunter should take the shot? Sasquatch doesn't exist. You realize you're wasting your time. Well, that actually may not be the case. Again, we can apply the discussion to any number of as yet undiscovered animal species. Yes, in the traditions of taxonomy, you would collect a specimen, and therefore it could be completely studied in the laboratory. But the problem is, what happens if the specimen you collect is indeed the last one? Now, a lot of people would say that's highly unlikely, but if we're talking about a critically endangered population of animals, for instance, the late great thylacine or Tasmanian tiger, the last known specimen, which, again, at one time there was what was presumed to be a single final existing specimen in a museum, or rather, I should say, in a zoo. And once it died, we were faced with the tragic reality of the death of an entire population of animals. Maybe. Now, the hopeful side of this coin is that in remote portions of Tasmania, and maybe even on the Australian mainland, that we actually do still have small pockets of critically endangered Tasmanian tigers. And if that is indeed the case, it all the more makes the case for protecting these animals. And so, again, I actually wanted to talk to you a little about the Tasmanian tiger because you had brought that one up. And yet again, this is one of these animals that many cryptozoological enthusiasts kind of see as a poster child for cryptozoology, which shows here again all the importance of having these discussions. Whether or not you believe in something like Sasquatch, there are animals that have been known to exist on Earth and which may still be out there, but the conservationist side of me is saying, you know, we've really got to emphasize their protection, right? What do you think about the Tasmanian tiger and its possible thriving?
Yeah, well, I'm also hopeful that they're still around. And I think that there is a very good possibility of that just by numbers, for instance. Let me draw a comparison. Mm-hmm. You know, we in our corner of the world, there's a lot of red foxes. Okay?
Yeah.
So they are beautiful animals. You know, you can see them. I did some calculations. I live in a semi-rural part of Pennsylvania called Chester County. Okay? So there's a lot of farms. There's some cities. My university is in Chester County. You get the picture.
Yeah.
So, Chester County is about 800 square miles, give or take. Okay? And according to the best estimate of the population of red foxes, there's about maybe two, maybe two and a half foxes per square mile. Right? So, that means that in Chester County, there could be maybe 1,600 red foxes. Okay, so far so good?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Okay, so I've lived here for about 15 years. I've seen only one red fox in all those years.
Wow.
Okay, so they are not very big animals. They are certainly not dumb. They know how to hide. They know how to avoid being seen by enemies. They know how to hunt. So it's entirely conceivable that in a place like Australia or Tasmania, that it's a little bit larger than Chester County.
Yes.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
We can find a population of Tasmanian tigers.
Yeah.
So, but that's again my hope. My semi-quantitative hope.
Right. Absolutely. Well, you know, it's very interesting because I can relate to the enigma of the red fox there. And in fact, actually, I had a very unique experience a few years ago. I was coming home on a holiday. It was a Monday, and so everybody was off from work, and I'd gone over to visit my friends across town, and we were having brunch. And on my way home, I saw a very peculiar animal lurking near a fence line. By all intents and purposes, this was probably the mythical chupacabra that I had seen. And yes, I snapped photographs of it, and I contacted a biologist who put me in touch with an animal welfare group, and basically they sent out someone to look for this animal. What we were clearly seeing was a red fox with mange. And and I have seen a lot of reports in the media over the years that talk about everything from coyotes to raccoons to red foxes that when stricken with mange look very uncharacteristic and therefore can sometimes fool people. And I think that at times we have to take into consideration that a population of, for instance, red foxes or similar animals, if they are stricken with a condition like mange, it can lead to speculations about other varieties of creature as a result of misidentification. And I think in terms of cryptozoology, that is something that should be taken into consideration too, the fact that known species under certain conditions can be misidentified, right?
Yeah, I agree with you. And there's also the matter of genetic variability. That they can even be of the same species or because of, I don't know, malnutrition or like disease, like mange and whatnot, they look like completely different thing.
That's really interesting. I want to jump back over really briefly to Orang Pendak because I had wanted to share an account that's really interesting, and I'm sure you're familiar with this one also. This was from Charles A. Smith, dated September 11th, 1924. This was an article, I believe it was November 9th, 1924. I read the date backwards, but the title of the article that appeared in the Nevada State Journal was "Reported Find of Missing Link Will Be Probed." Now, of course, I think missing link, that whole idea is something of a misnomer. in the sense that if we understand evolution, there's not going to be some missing link between primates and humans. That evolutionary process is a gradual one. But nonetheless, the account that is given in this article is one that has compelled a lot of people, and it reads as follows. I discovered a dark and hairy creature on a branch. The sadapa, as it was referred to, was also hairy on the front of its body. The color there was a little lighter than on the back. The very dark hair on its head fell to just below the shoulder blades, or even almost to the waist. Had it been standing, its arms would have reached to a little above its knees. They were therefore long, but its legs seemed to me rather short. I did not see its feet, but I did see some toes which were shaped in a very normal manner. There was nothing repulsive or ugly about its face, nor was it ape-like. Very interesting description of a small, human-like primate observed in 1924. And at that time, this had really spurred debate about the so-called Orang Pendek. And, of course, the speculations that this might be some sort of a hominin very similar to humans. Now, with the discovery in more recent years of Homo floresiensis, the famous hobbits of the island of Flores, they're no longer there. This is a Pleistocene, that is, during the last ice age, population on an island of very small human-like creatures. You know, some have tried to say that they were essentially a dwarf variety of Homo erectus or something similar to that, but there doesn't seem to be any clear indication of, in the fossil record or otherwise, Homo erectus making their way to the island of Flores. And thus, some anthropologists maintain that the Homo floresiensis is indeed something unique and distinct among ancient hominid varieties. And others have noted yet again that, well, in addition to the general size and description of these so-called hobbits, they are remarkably similar to the reports of Orang Pendek. So could Orang Pendek, in fact, be a living fossil in that same way?
I would say so, yeah, provided that it's something like that. I mean, I would say so, definitely.
Yeah, there's always that possibility, at least. And yep. And who knows, there may be other species out there as yet undiscovered. But, One, as we're kind of wrapping up here, I do want to ask you, as an educator, as someone who is interested in biology and who's willing to look at some of that more fringe kind of stuff, as well as, you know, have a firm ground in what science has taught us about organisms and really the remarkable diversity that we find in the biological sciences, when you speak to your students about this and you try to inspire them to get involved and to pursue maybe even a career in the study of life and its mysteries, you know, what are the big takeaways and what do you try to convey to your students about getting interested in the importance of studying biology?
Biodiversity, in one word. Okay, and wow. I will elaborate a little bit on that. I'm a big fan of biodiversity writ large, as it were. Because sometimes I get nostalgic of the things that I will never see. I don't know if I'm making too much sense, but I will explain. I would love to see an actual saber-toothed tiger from a distance. Okay?
Oh, yeah.
Or a T-Rex. So many organisms that are part of the majestic biodiversity of our planet, of which we will never be able to know anything about them because they never left a fossil trace. Okay? Even though we have a lot of fossil remains, fossilization is a rather rare phenomenon, believe it or not. And the vast majority of organisms that have graced our planet will forever be unknown to us. Also, the biodiversity that may be out there. We talk about panspermia and life in other planets, things like that. The biodiversity of the universe, past, present, and future. What can be more fascinating than that? Sometimes I also tell them about the exceptions of biology. Okay, organisms that can be either classified as plants or animals, depending on the point of view. I try to give them the general idea, but also the exceptions to try to kindle their curiosity. I also try to impress upon them to keep an open mind, but paraphrasing Carl Sagan, not to keep your mind so open that your brains will fall out.
Right.
As it were.
Yes.
So, my final message in this segment of the program is that whatever life is, it's fascinating and it's worth conserving.
Very well said, and I wholeheartedly agree. One, why don't you tell us a little, by the way, about where people can find more about you online and follow your work? I know you have a blog and you've got a lot of different things online that people can follow.
Okay, well, I have a Twitter handle. It's called @BaldScientist for obvious reasons. Okay, and that's also the name of my blog, baldscientist.wordpress.com. And, of course, I also have an Amazon author's page and everything. But in the blog, you can find all the information on how to find me and or get in touch with me and essentially geek out about science and biology.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, anybody who follows me on Twitter, you'll already be seeing me interacting with One on Twitter an awful lot. He and Lauren and I and our good pal Rune over in the land of ice and snow, a number of us are regularly in touch there in the Twitterverse. So definitely check him out. The Bald Scientist, you can find him in all those places if you go online and search for that. Or One, one, in other words, O-N-E, One R Pagan. Go search for that. You'll find his books and all of his information online. I just want to thank you for spending time with us today. This has been such a fun conversation. And in these trying times, it is important to remember, like you said earlier, in the words of the great Dr. Ian Malcolm, life does find a way, even if our survival is at times kind of strange. So you're putting the strange in staying strange this week, my friend.
And I thank you so much for having me on. And I thank you for doing this for all of us. Because, again, in these trying times, information is power, and especially information that can take our minds off the awful things that can be happening around. I mean, my friend, you're doing a great service, and I thank you.
Well, your kind words are more than appreciated, my friend, and thank you for the good work that you do on this National Doctors Day. So thanks again to One R. Pagan, author of Strange Survivors. We will have that linked in the show notes for you. Definitely check out his book, and we'll have a little more from One for subscribers as well. As far as the main show, that about wraps it up. This show is produced in Asheville, North Carolina. Our executive producers back at Master Control in Ogden, Utah are Race Hobbs and Warren Breger. News tips are provided by Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, and Adam Olson. Music featured on this show is produced by Caleb Hanks, and other show content for this program is produced every week by the wonderful Lauren Ellis. Special thanks goes out to Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Robin Hobbs, Tiffany Mack, Jason Pintrail, James Waldo, and Matthew Oakley. I am Micah Hanks, and on behalf of all of us here in the bunker, thanks for listening, and as always, stay strange out there.